we have
more confidence. Whose family? Like, think about how your family and your life would change if you have more real, pure, authentic, vital confidence pumping through your veins on a daily basis. That would change things for you, wouldn't it? Sade's going to come on stage, and she's not going to teach us to fake it till we make it when it comes to confidence. She's going to teach us to be it until we become it. And it's so powerful, you guys. We get online and we scroll, and I'm a victim of it. I'll doom scroll instead of going to sleep because I got the loan scaries at 10 p.m. from an email from my underwriter. And then I'm just doom scrolling. But every once in a while in your doom scroll, you'll come across an account that's literally worth hundreds of thousands of dollars in which you would have paid a coach or therapist to teach you. So I can't even wait, because how many of you guys have seen one of the 45-second reels that gave you a whole new perspective or changed the way you felt? Yeah, she does that in 45 seconds. So how excited are you to see what she's going to pour into us, given a whole keynote? Yes? You excited about your feet? So we can welcome to the stage, Sade.
Combat self-doubt doesn't affect us.
But if any one of these are deficient or weak, that is where self-doubt attacks. So I want to share with you what these four things are, because what the research says, my research and decades of research before, once we know what these four things are for each of you and where you fall in your little profile, as we call it, your doubt profile, it's a solid predictor of how much success you will have, how satisfied you will be in your career, how you respond to challenges, and how much money you will make, regardless of where you start out. Before I get to the four things, though, there is one underlying principle that we need to understand in order to make everything else work. And I have a little piece of research to make it super clear for you. So back in the 1970s, a psychology professor by the name of Robert Kleck from Dartmouth conducted a fascinating experiment. He brought participants into a room, and he drew a scar on their cheek, from their ear on the right side of their face to the right side of their mouth. He then let them see themselves in a mirror, so they could see, okay, I've got this ugly scar on my face. And then he sent them into conversations with strangers. Now, after the conversations, he asked them, how do you feel the conversation went? And collectively, they overwhelmingly stated that they felt like they were treated differently because of their scar. They felt like people judged them, there was discomfort, there was tension. But you know what's really fascinating? There actually was no scar. Before the participants went into these conversations, the researcher applied moisturizing cream to the scar to say, hey, this will help it set, so it won't crack. But what he actually did was remove it entirely. These people went into these conversations believing that they had a facial disfigurement, and that's what they experienced. It was entirely because of the beliefs that they had, which created an expectation, which created the reality they experienced. And this is called expectation bias. And it is a dangerous bias. You see what you expect rather than what actually happens. When you expect judgment, rejection, criticism, you see it even if it's not there. You're not responding to reality, you're responding to the version that your brain is projecting onto reality. And this is so important to understand. Dr. Maxwell Maltz, has anyone read the book Psycho-Cybernetics? Fantastic book. He was a plastic surgeon, and he became an author, and he calls this belief that we have about ourselves, he calls it our self-image. It's the mental blueprint you carry about who you are. And it influences how we navigate life and how we perceive things. Now, he saw this play out in a really interesting way in his plastic surgery clinic. So patients would come to him with a desire to fix a part of themselves. There was some flaw that they wanted to fix, and their logic was pretty straightforward. It was, once I fix this flaw, then I will be successful. Then I will have more lucky relationships. Then everything will work out. It will be better. Do you think that's what happened? Absolutely not. What he realized, what he noticed, is that most of these patients still felt, thought, and acted exactly the same after the surgery. Why? They hadn't updated their blueprint. The blueprint stayed the same for the self-doubt leader. So before we go any further, I'd like to encourage you to ask yourself, what belief is shaping how you walk into a room? What invisible scars are you carrying that you're not addressing? Because who you believe you are is the blueprint for your entire life. Write this down, take a photo of it. This is such an important truth. Who you believe you are is the blueprint of your entire life. Okay, so now to these four pillars. Based on my research with over 4,000 people, 4.5 years worth, what I found is that with a solid certainty, regardless of your background, who you are, where you're from, where you start out, your self-doubt will show up in relation to one of these four areas. If you have a deficiency in any one of them, that is where self-doubt will hit. Basically like driving a car with 1, 2, 3, or 4 flat tires. And what is also really fascinating is that these four create the internal infrastructure behind every high-performance visible success. Show me anybody. Give me 15 minutes to talk to them, to really ask them deep questions, and I can tell you what their doubt profile is based on these four, and why they've been able to either succeed because of it, or why it's holding them back. That's how powerful this is. So who wants to know what they are? Give me a yes.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah, let me hear that one more time. Who wants to know what they are? Give me a yes.
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 Do it. The very first pillar relates to acceptance. which is a reflection of your self-esteem. It answers the question of, am I enough as I am? Now, kids who grew up in environments where they felt like they had to fight for their parents' attention, they didn't get the emotional support that they needed, they generally grow up feeling like their worth is contingent on approval, validation. It can also happen where you develop this need for validation if you're just really indebted to your parents. You feel so grateful that they gave you a wonderful life that you don't want to disappoint them. It can also happen if you have a sibling who was a really difficult child and you saw that and you didn't want to be that and so you became the good kid. This is me. Anyone else resonate with this? It leads to a lack of acceptance, which means as an adult you're always performing, you're overcompensating, you're chasing approval, you hide your real self to make yourself more palatable to other people. It sounds really soft, but this is the hardest for high performers to develop in themselves. And in our research, 54% of people struggle with this. So if it's not you, it's the person next to you. I'm going to share with you two of the greatest hurdles when it comes to acceptance, and then actions you can take to elevate your baseline. Who is this individual? Anyone recognize this person with the fabulous head of hair? Andre Agassi. Now, it's enviable, seriously, look at it. At the age of 19, he started losing his hair. And he was so deeply ashamed of it that he started wearing a hairpiece. He was so insecure. Now, the breaking point happened in 1990 at the French Open. He made it to the finals, the Grand Slam finals. The night before the finals, catastrophe strikes. He washes his hairpiece with the wrong shampoo, and it starts falling apart. His brother salvages it together with 20 bobby pins. Us ladies in the audience know that bobby pins don't do anything by way of security. He was filled with anxiety, absolutely consumed with this idea of being exposed. He said, I prayed, not for a win, but for my hairpiece to stay on. And this obsession with hiding his real self and putting on a mask in front of his hairpiece consumed him day to day. And he lost 3 sets to 1. And the thing is, we actually do this too, not with a hairpiece, but in terms of how we show up. We make ourselves more acceptable to other people to be accepted based on what we think they expect of us. In his case, it was a hairpiece. In our case, we might say yes when we really need no. We might soften our feedback so we don't hurt people's feelings. We dress to fit in. We filter our ideas to stay comfortable. And if you're not sure if you do any of these, think about what beliefs you have that starts with an I should. In his case, in Andre Agassi's case, it was I'm 19, or you know, I'm young, I shouldn't be losing my hair, I should have a full head of hair. For you, it might be, I am a leader, I should have all the answers, so I'm not going to ask questions. Think about what your shoulds are. This insecurity led him to sacrifice the greatest moment of his career. Now, the problem with trying to hide a part of yourself is that you become hyper-attuned to those very parts. You start scanning and assessing to make sure no one sees them. As psychotherapist Phil Stutt says, you become obsessed with how they see me, what they think of me, do they like me, love me? And it holds you back. This is the cost of impression management, and it infiltrates every aspect of your life. In business, you might default to the safe option because you don't want to take risks just in case. With clients, you hesitate, so then they see that hesitation, and then they hesitate, and then they don't have the confidence in you to make a buying decision. As a leader, you might filter your ideas, you filter your feedback, you don't give your team what they need to succeed and thrive. And then at home, you're stuck overthinking your day and all of your interactions and what do they mean by that and how do they think about me? You're not there physically present with your loved ones. Or rather, you're physically present, but you're not emotionally and mentally there. It can be really damaging. Now back to Agassi. After this crushing loss at the 1990 game, his girlfriend at the time, Brooke Shields, I didn't know that they were together, but Brooke Shields said to him, why don't you just shave your head? And he said, impossible, I would feel naked. And he said, no, you would feel liberated. Well, he thought about it, he decided to do it. When he turned up to the 1995 Australian Open, he was bold and unburdened, and he dominated. When he got to the finals, he was competing against defending champion Pete Sampras, and he won 3 sets to 1. He reflected in his memoir, in his book, Everyone says it was my best performance yet, but I think 20 years from now, I'll remember this as my first bold victory. He accepted who he was. He didn't try to hide. And it allowed him to perform to his peak. Fundamentally, acceptance is about this idea. What they think matters less when you accept yourself first. Don't outsource your sense of worth or value to anyone or anything outside of yourself. So in order to elevate your baseline of acceptance, the first action is to ask yourself, what is my metaphorical hairpiece? What am I clinging to for validation that's actually holding me back and preventing me from moving forward? And again, back to these shoulds. If I believe that I should, fill in the blank. Maybe it's time to do something else instead. And every time you do that, every time you break one of these rules, because a should is a rule that we impose on ourselves. Every time you break one of these in a small way, it's an act of ownership. And it activates the nucleus accumbens in the brain. Sorry, the striatum in the brain. And the striatum is associated with surprise rewards. So what happens is authenticity starts to feel really good, not risky. And it also acts as a proof point. All the things that you were worried about didn't happen. And that's evidence that you can use going forward. So obviously stories about a hairpiece, a physical piece that he wore to hide a part of himself. Sometimes though, it's not about something that we're doing to hide a part of ourselves. It's about a standard that we have imposed on ourselves that is getting in our way. Who's familiar with this book? Or the movie, the Julia Roberts? It's the memoir of Elizabeth Gilbert. Now, it's a memoir, so you would think that it's easy to write. It's your story. But before the book, before the global tour, before the Oprah interview, before it turned into a movie, Elizabeth Gilbert was stuck trying to write her memoir. She was absolutely stuck. She had this mantra of, this sucks, ringing through her head every time she came to write anything at all. Nothing was good enough. And she was stuck in this whirlwind of self-criticism. And then she had a moment of clarity. She said, hold on. I never promised the universe that I would write brilliantly. I only promised it that I would write. So why don't I just do that? And that's what she did, line by line, paragraph by paragraph, and it became a global bestseller. She focused on the process, not the outcome. That can always be improved later. Now, what does this look like for you? When you focus on the outcome, you are blocking yourself, because often we want the outcome to be the best it can possibly be. A lot of us are perfectionists, and if something is not going to be at that standard, we don't want to try until we feel ready. But when it comes to focusing on the process for you, it might look like starting to build a billion-dollar business, just get your first paying customer. Don't stress about perfecting your brand, just launch that website. Don't stress about going viral, just post something. Don't make succeed the objective, just start. Now, I have my own experience with this idea of focusing on the process. And I want to take you back to the year 2020. Does everyone remember what they were doing in that year? We're in the middle of COVID, we're in lockdown, and our business was dead. Every client event that we had was canceled or indefinitely postponed, and we know what that means. We didn't know what to do, we were twiddling our thumbs. And then I had the idea, okay, well, if our business is about helping can't go to companies or events to help people there, how do we reach people where they are? Well, everyone was at home, in lockdown, on their devices. So I thought, why don't I try and create content on social media? So I created 40 pieces of video content in one day. Set up my iPhone. It was very basic. I just changed my outfit and my hair. Which meant I had 40 pieces of content, 40 days worth of content, and I put it back down for 40 days. That single act of doing something, let me tell you, was not perfect, the audio was off, the lighting was terrible, even what I was saying wasn't great. But that act of embracing that messy imperfection and focusing on the process of posting, it exploded our business to 7 figures in 3 years. It's the reason I'm here in front of you right now. Simply because I focused on the process of posting, not waiting until something felt perfect or until I felt ready. Because we have this myth in our mind that I will take action when I feel ready, and I know when that will be. But here's the really interesting thing. Ready is not an emotion. Ready is not an emotion. And usually, ready only comes once you started. You have to start the thing to show yourself that you can do the thing, and then you feel ready to keep doing it. So it's linked to momentum. So in order to improve your, elevate your baseline of acceptance. We started with our shoulds and our things that we're doing for validation. This one is really around making good enough for now the goal. Don't make perfect your goal, just good enough for now. And it even works with a gym workout. Let's say you had a gym workout that wasn't very intense. Don't beat yourself up. Say, that's okay, good enough for now. You build consistency, I will do better next time.
Joe would disagree.
Back who you are, as you are, I take it from there. Quality will catch up in quantity. The more you do anything, the better you will inevitably get, but you have to do the thing. So acceptance, when you start to question, and bear in mind, this is not really something you consciously think. It is a subconscious thing that you will be experiencing. When you start to feel like you're not enough as you are, remind yourself, I'm enough as a work in progress, I can always get better. So this is our first pillar, acceptance, relates to self-esteem. The second pillar is agency. Self-doubt doesn't always refer to a feeling of not enoughness or worthiness. Sometimes it relates to a question of, can I do it? Can I actually do it? And it relates to your belief that you have in your capability and your skills. Can you do the thing? Now, surprisingly, some of the most accomplished people I have ever worked with, the founders, the CEO, the execs, the athletes, they're living their lives with this voice in their head telling them, you're not as good as everyone else thinks you are. Yeah, you might have won that or built that business, but you're a fraud. You don't deserve your success. They have this voice in their heads. What's really fascinating with agency, which relates to self-efficacy, if we're looking at the term in psychology, there's this really interesting paradox, which I think you'll resonate with. The better you get at something, the more invisible your expertise becomes to others and yourself, because suddenly it's really easy for you. And often we come to equate effort with value. There's a fascinating study that was done. You might have heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect. Basically, researchers David Dunning and Justin Kruger conducted a series of experiments, and they found, fascinatingly, that people with very little knowledge overestimate their ability because they don't yet know what they don't know. They don't know how much there is to know, so of course they feel satisfied. Of course they feel like they know what they need to know. Conversely, the more someone knows about something, the more they undervalue or underestimate their ability in that space. And to help it make more sense, I'm going to map it out for you. So when you start anything, it's really easy to feel positive. Quick little example for me. I've just finished 4.5 years of PhD research. I recently submitted my thesis. Hardest thing I've ever done. Has anyone done it? Has anyone in the audience who has done a PhD? If you have, absolute respect. It's really hard. I submitted it and I wanted to celebrate, so I said, I'm going to learn the bass guitar. That's going to be my way of celebrating. So before I even bought the bass guitar, I started watching these videos on YouTube, these little riffs, and I would play along in the air. And I thought, this is easy, like, this is coming really naturally to me, I'm going to be a complete natural. My confidence is really high. Then I went and bought the bass guitar. And after about 45 minutes of playing, my fingertips were burning. My fingers hurt from being stretched. I took it out of the case maybe 2 other times, and I haven't taken it out since. When I was really confident, I was in the peak of Mount Stupid. I didn't know what I didn't know. And then as soon as I realized, wow, this is actually really hard. Any bass guitarist in the room? It's a cool instrument. It's a hard instrument. Cool instrument. I dropped into the valley of despair. And this happens with anything. And this is where people quit. This is where people give up. This is too hard. I don't think I can do this. This is where your agency gets undermined. But if you continue at it, if you continue working consistently, slowly, your competence will increase and your confidence will match. You'll reach the slope of enlightenment, and if you keep going, you'll reach the plateau of sustainability where confidence matches competence. When you struggle with agency, it rewrites this graph. You don't really ever get out of the valley of despair. You're always doubting. You never think like you're good enough. Your competence, your skills are increasing. You're getting really good at the thing, but your confidence is not matching. Imposter syndrome, have we heard of that? That lives here. You feel like a fraud. And the reason why this happens is because your skills have become muscle memory. You don't even realize the years of experience that you have developed and the expertise that you've honed. You're just looking at your here and now, and it's so easy to overlook everything else. I want to share a story about this, but first, before I got to Las Vegas, I was in San Diego for a few days to get over the jet lag, because I live basically like, I'm 12 hours away. I live in Koh Samui, which is an island off the east coast of Thailand. So it takes a little while to get used to that, so I always come in a few days early. San Diego's got great weather, so I picked there. And I took a photo of this building because it's pretty, and I like taking photos of buildings. And then I noticed the logo, the Citibank logo, and it reminded me of this story that I thought I have to share. Back in 1998, Paula Scher, she's the legendary graphic designer, she was hired by Citigroup to develop their new logo. There was a merger and they needed a new logo, so she's sitting at this meeting, getting briefed. She grabs a napkin and she starts scribbling on the napkin. Within a matter of seconds, she slides this napkin across the table. She goes, "Here's your logo." Everyone on that table was stunned. They said, "How can it be that it's done in just a matter of seconds?" And Paula Scher, she sat there and she smiled and she said, "It's done in a second of 34 years. It's done in a second of every experience, of everything that's in my head. You didn't just get me through a few seconds, you got all of that." The lesson here is that your competencies go far deeper than what is visibly observable to other people and even to yourself. What Paula didn't forget is that her agency isn't just based on how she feels here and now, it's everything that she's brought to the table. And just so you know, that's the logo they actually went with, and they paid her $1.5 million for it. When it comes to agency, it's not just getting the job done. It's trusting the value of what you've already done, even if it doesn't look like effort, even if no one else sees the story behind it. Now, this is really hard to do when you're stepping into something completely new. And I want to share a story that illustrates this. So Tinker Hatfield, the architect Tinker Hatfield, back in 1985, Nike, shoe brand, footwear brand, or, you know, they've expanded since then. Back then it was mainly shoes. They faced challenges. Their stock price was declining. They'd just gone through massive layoffs. They were struggling to get into the basketball market. They needed fresh talent. So they hosted a 24-hour shoe design competition. And Tinker Hatfield, architect, with exactly zero experience in footwear design, entered, and he won. For his first official shoe design, he took inspiration from the Centre Pompidou in Paris. I have no idea if that's how you say it, but it sounds like a background sounded fancy. Centre Pompidou. It's an inside-out building. So things that would typically be on the inside of the building, like the circulation system, etc., is all on the outside, and it's by design. He learned about this in architecture school. And he thought, how about we do that to a shoe? So he grabbed a notebook and he started sketching a design, and he put the Nike swoosh on it, and he created a visible air pocket. And this shoe became the Nike Air Max 1. Some people in the company say that Tinker Hatfield, with exactly zero experience in footwear design, single-handedly saved Nike in the 80s. Now he says, Tinker says, when he's reflecting on this experience, he says, when you sit down to create something, anything, what you create is a combination of everything you've seen and done previous to that point. What is the lesson here? Skills are transferable. Tinker transferred his architectural thinking into a completely new medium. And so the point of this is that you don't need experience in something to bring value to it. Too often we take ourselves out of the game because we think that we're not qualified to do something, but you have experience in other areas. Your skills, your eye, your instincts, your intuition, your perspective, your innovative thinking, they're hard-earned. It's not always visible to other people, but behind the scenes, you have been developing it. It's the 34 years behind the napkin. It's the architect behind the Nike Air Max 1. And sometimes having no experience in something actually makes you even more valuable. Something that my husband and I do, part of our business, is we invest in other businesses that we really believe in. And we recently invested in a business which is in the regenerative medical space. It is the fastest growing sector in medicine. It's fascinating what they're able to do. And the founders and us, we have zero experience in medicine. My husband Faisal and I, we have worked with the medical industry, working with its leaders, working with its companies and medtech startups. We don't have that much experience in that space. The founders of this company, one of them is a former head strategist at Samsung, and the other one worked in operations for private jets and train logistics. None of us have experience, but you know what that gives us? A different way of seeing things. A different way of seeing the problem, different ways to commercialize, a different way to help more people en masse through regenerative medicine. So not having experience can actually be a massive bonus. So what do we need to do here to develop our agency, this second pillar? It's all about stopping yourself from disqualifying yourself before you start something. Don't disqualify yourself, give it a go, try. Ask, when have I already solved problems like this, just in a different form? Find ways to bring that experience forward, adapt it, maybe use it. But even when we have earned skills, we can still fall into a trap that erodes our agency fast. And it relates to this question, do you often compare yourself to other people? Now, the fact of the matter is we do this all the time. It has a social function. From an evolutionary perspective, we compare ourselves to others in the group to make sure that we belong, we fit, others trust us, they have our back. And we're still wired to do this. The problem is in today's world, without objective markers, we use other people as a mirror to evaluate our skills and abilities. And when you struggle with agency, when you have self-doubt, your brain is not looking for mutual comparisons. It's looking for proof that you are not good enough, you are falling behind. Everyone is ahead of you. And that's not very helpful for us, is it? And of course, social media only fuels this. Comparison forces you outwards to what everyone else is doing. So we need to find a way to bring us back to our own lane. And this is where we can take a lesson from the Olympic swimming pool. So Michael Phelps is one of the greatest athletes of all time. He had an unusual strategy. He used to visualize. Now, that's not particularly unusual, but his coach said he would visualize every unexpected thing that could happen, and then how he would overcome it. Goggles snapping, slipping on the starting blocks, getting a cramp mid-race. He would visualize these so that it became ingrained in his nervous system, and then visualize what he would do if that were to ever occur, so that if it did, he could just rely on his training, his mental training. And this is a process called inversion, where you take every possible obstacle, and you become aware of it before you start, and then you find out, how do I mitigate it from happening? And then what do I do if it actually happens? So it could be thinking about, okay, well, if this project were to fail, what could have caused the failure? If I ran out of resources, what would be the reason? If I forget what I'm saying mid-speech, what would have caused it? If this marketing campaign flops, what assumptions did we get wrong? You want to think, what can I do to prevent it from happening? And then if it happens, what do I do? And you visualize this. This builds your agency, because then no matter what happens, you are prepared for it. Now this strategy worked really well for Michael Phelps. It really paid off in 2008 in the finals of the 200 meter butterfly. Does anyone know what happened? Almost immediately after he dove into the pool, his goggles filled up with water. He couldn't see anything. But instead of getting distracted about how far ahead everyone else was getting or getting stuck in his head, he just defaulted to his training. And as he said, I swam line for 175 meters out of a 200 fly, won gold, and broke a world record. And this is all without being able to see a thing because he anticipated it and he knew how to respond. So what does this mean for us? What are the goggles filled with water moments that you can prepare for right now? How do you anticipate the worst, practice your response, trust your preparation, and then take action? This is how you can elevate your agency. So when you start to question, can I do this? Remind yourself, I can figure this out as I go. I've done it before and I will do it again. Let's move to the third pillar now. This is autonomy. And it answers the question, when ahead to plus, here we go. Oh, the second half of that word hasn't come out. Do I have any guesses what the rest of this sentence is? Do I have power? Do I have control? And specifically it relates to this question of where do you place the in your life? Do you feel like you're in control of your decisions in your life? Or do other people are pulling the shots? A story that illustrates what this looks like. We all are aware of Tom Brady, NFL legend, quarterback. He faced a challenge with autonomy early in his career. He was in his second year at the University of Michigan, playing for the Wolverines, I think they're called. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Playing for the Michigan Wolverines, second year, and he was benched. And he was frustrated because he was only getting two reps. during practice time and referred to a limited number of practice opportunities. And he was complaining to everybody, they're not giving me a shot here, what's the point? I'm only getting two reps. His coach spoke to him about it and said, oh, this is a problem. You're constantly focusing on what everyone else is doing. Please go to the counselor, the sports psychologist. So young Tom thought, okay, fine, I'll do that. Go to see Greg Harlan, the sports psychologist at the University of Michigan. And the very first thing that he says is, they're not giving me a shot, I'm only getting two reps. He went straight into his complaining cycle again. And Greg listened, and he responded with, okay, well, just go in there and focus with the two that you got and make them as perfect as you possibly can. And that simple reframe shifted Tom from an external focus, look at what everyone else is doing, this is so unfair, to internal, what can I do with what I've got? And he said he showed up to every single practice. Those two reps, he showed up like it was the Super Bowl. He brought his enthusiasm, his energy, his attention. Those two reps became four. The four became eight. And soon enough, he was the starter. So what is the lesson from this? Whether you're aware of it or not, you have a belief about how much control you have in your life, and it comes down to where you focus. If you have an internal locus of control, you focus on things that you can control, which means you feel like you have more power in your life. You focus on your thoughts, your words, your responses, your actions. You are aware that there are things that you have no control over, but you don't choose to focus there. Alternatively, if you have an external locus of control, you're focusing on everything that you cannot do anything about. So naturally, you feel powerless because you are powerless to change things. So quick autonomy action. Stop complaining and focusing on what you cannot control. It is not going to get you anywhere. Ask yourself, what can I control today? How can I show up like it already matters? How can I make every single rep count? Now the fact is though, well, even if you have an internal locus of control, your autonomy is high, there are still things that can happen to you that are devastating, that feel completely unfair, that you are powerless to change. And Peter Vest experienced this when he was a young man. When he was 19 years old, Peter Vest was the drummer of a scrappy little boy band, and they were just on the brink of something really exciting happening. They could feel it. For 2 years, they worked alongside each other and planned their future together. Then, just as this band was about to take off, he gets pulled into the manager's office. So he goes in and he sits down, and the manager says, "Look, Peter, we're replacing him." It wasn't really even an explanation, just that we're replacing him with some guy with a really weird name, Ringo. Does anyone know which band this was? The Beatles, right before their global mega stardom. How would that feel if that were you? How do you think you would feel? Peter was devastated. He went into a depression. He tried to take his own life. But today, many decades later, he has chosen to tell a different story. He says, "I'm happy, I have no complaints. I've enjoyed life, I couldn't change anything." He has chosen to change the story that he tells about a situation in his life that would have fundamentally changed his life. He actually says, if you hold on to resentment, you're only going to end up being twisted and bitter old kid, which is such an English thing to say, so very Peter. When he was reflecting on it, he said, you know, all the things that have happened to me, good and bad, happy and sad, they made me who I am today. So he's acknowledging things could have been very different, but this is who he is, this is the life that he's got, and he's going to focus on the things that he appreciates, like his wife of 50 years, his two daughters, his grandchildren. What he's chosen to do is change what's called his narrative identity. Narrative identity is the term that is given to the stories that we're constantly telling, whether we're aware of them or not, about who we are, about our self-image, about the role that we play in our lives. Professor Dr. Daniel McAdams has been studying this for over 40 years, and he's found that you can change your story at any point in time. You can edit your personal narrative to make yourself feel like you have greater autonomy. You're not changing the facts, because we cannot change history, but you're changing the meaning that you assign to those facts. And this can have an incredible influence on your self-image, what we covered right at the beginning. You can't rewrite history, but you can rewrite what it means. And this changes everything about how you move forward. And this is how you elevate your autonomy. So reframe your story from failure to growth, from victim to strategist. Think about who you were before the setback and who you want to be after the setback. And then make your story work for that person that you want to be. Make that story every step of the way, every experience you've had, like Peter said, it made you who you are, and then have you align behind who you want to become. So this is autonomy. When self-doubt makes you feel like you are powerless, remind yourself, I can shape my path one decision at a time. I'm going to focus on what is controllable. And lastly, the last pillar is adaptability. Now, in the context of doubt, adaptability refers specifically to how you handle your emotions, how you handle your emotions. So it answers the question of, again, this one's missing, any ideas what the rest of this would have said? Can I handle it? Specifically, can I handle the emotions that come with it? Because that's the deeper question. Think about a moment when self-doubt hit. The last experience you had, what did it feel like? Maybe it was dread curling in your stomach. Maybe it was a spike in heart rate when you were about to share something important. Maybe it's a heaviness that sits on your chest when you're scrolling on LinkedIn. Now, imagine that same situation, but strip all of the emotion out of it. Suddenly, now there's no emotion. What are you left with? Just a bunch of thoughts. And when you're just left with a bunch of thoughts, you can be really rational about that. You can make pros and cons. You can assess if they make sense for you or not. So the point here is that self-doubt, what gives self-doubt its destructive quality is the emotion that attaches to it. Once you strip the emotion out, it's just a bunch of thoughts. Self-doubt has a heavy emotional profile, and it's the emotion that holds us back. Because the truth is, out-of-control emotions can make smart people stupid. And it's because of what's going on in the brain. Blood is rushing to your limbic system. It cuts off communication to your prefrontal cortex. Prefrontal cortex is what we need for rationality and logic. We literally don't have the part of our brain that makes us smart. So what do? The fact is, as adults, we're terrible. We are remarkably terrible at knowing what we're feeling in a given moment. We're really bad at it. And it's because we have better things to be doing. We have people to see, meetings to attend, kids that are hungry that need to be fed. But I met with a venture capitalist by the name of Kate, highly successful businesswoman, and as I was catching up with her at 4 o'clock, she got a notification on her phone. And she said, oh, that's my self-check-in. What is a self-check-in? She said, at 4 o'clock every day, I get a notification to check in with myself. And it reminds me to ask two questions. What am I feeling right now? And next, is this emotion serving me? So it forces her to become aware of what she's feeling and then ask, is this serving me for where I need to be right now? Let's say she needs to really focus on an investor pitch. She needs to have that level of clarity. If she does, in that moment, great, she keeps going. But let's say she is overthinking, she's fidgety, she's aggravated. She then asks herself, what can I do to refocus and give this the attention it deserves? And for her, it was going for a walk around the block, calling a friend, having some water, little strategies she could take. This is a simple process to get better at self-monitoring. So I encourage you to find a process that works for you, because the better you self-monitor, the better you can manage your emotions. All the research says you will manage your emotions better, perform better, have greater focus. So this is fine if you've got the time to go for the walk, take the break. What about if you're in the moment, about to do something really important, and you don't have the luxury of doing something else? Can we transmute a negative emotion into something that's more beneficial? This is the question that Harvard's Elizabeth Bailey Wolf wanted to answer. Specifically, can changing how we interpret an emotion change how we perform under pressure? And so what she did is she brought a group of people together like this, and she put them in situations that were anxiety-inducing, stressful, like singing in public, or giving an impromptu talk to strangers. We're doing a maths exam. She asked half the group to say out loud, I'm excited. I'm excited. After they performed these things, the group that said, I'm excited out loud, not only experienced less anxiety, they were more confident and they performed better. This is an example of how in real time you can change how you're interpreting what you feel. Just by telling yourself, I'm excited, you're changing what the physiological sensation means for you in that moment, to harness it, to make it work. So this fourth pillar, how we develop it, monitor your emotions with some kind of a self-check-in, listen to what they're telling you, do something about them, and then make them work for you, not against you. So when you're thinking about, can I handle the emotions that come? come with this, kind of handle this. Remind yourself, I can feel this and still move forward. Don't allow your emotion to prevent you from doing what you want to do. You can also tap into other attributes to move forward. So these four elements, these four attributes, these four things, each of you will be at a different point. And depending on where you are, it creates what's called a big trust profile or a doubt profile, which tells us where you struggle. Because your doubt profile shapes your response to challenges, how you show up under pressure, and where you're most likely to get stuck. So I encourage you to take what we've covered today, reflect on where you might be lacking and how you can elevate that to get it to a baseline level, to increase that baseline. Because this will fundamentally transform how you show up, how you feel, what you feel like you're capable of doing, and ultimately your success. Now the final message I want to share with you, I've got about 40 seconds left. Self-doubt traps us because of the self part. The self part. It gets us stuck in this loop of I, me, mine. What do they think about me? How am I coming across? So we're hyper-focused on ourselves. The real unlock isn't actually in more self-focus. What do you think it is? It's in more other focus. It's in self-forgetting. The master key to self-mastery is self-forgetting. When you stop obsessing over you and how you're coming across or how you will perform and shift your focus to contribution or service, you no longer have to try and prove your worth because you're already living it. And that's a really powerful reframe. This is not new. This is embedded in ancient traditions and spiritual traditions that have been impacting how people live their lives for thousands of years. But science is now catching up, and they describe self-forgetting as a self-transcendent state, where you get out of your head, you quiet your ego, and you can confidently move forward. So again, I want to encourage you to find something that resonates with you, put it into practice, make it work for you, and if you can, try and find a way to make your business, to make your life about something other than yourself. It's an incredible, powerful reframe that will give you confidence like you never experienced before. So with that, I want to thank you all so, so much. We're going to end with a power clap. It's super quick. It's super easy. Rub your hands together. Actually, I need to tell you what it is first, and I'm now over time. When we work by ourselves, things can be very challenging. When we work together, we can achieve so much more. So a power clap is that idea of unity and success. It's really simple. I count back from three. I go 3, 2, 1, and then we clap. And we're going to do it once together. Get ready. Rub your hands together. 3, 2, 1. Thank you all so much for having me. Thank you, Neil and the team. Thank you for having me.
Exclusive merch if you want to grab a hat, sweatshirt, shirts, they're almost out of certain styles. So I just want to put that out there in case you want a new guide works, the fight won't be available tomorrow. And I think it's something that's already out. And then the second thing is, I just want to give you a quick update. If you want a cup of coffee or a quick snack, we just got some refreshments out here, so you don't have to go out to the casino. We just ordered that, so it'll be right at the foyer, so you can get a refresh. And then on the mastermind, I want to let you know that we have 22 spots left. The other spots are already filled of the 60. So congratulations to all the members who joined and all the new people. And if you're thinking about questioning and stuff, I'll be out in the foyer too. We can talk about it and jam up there. But let's take a quick 15-minute break and refresh and wrap up. All right? Thank you guys.